hello, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Mike the Gardener Gardening Podcast, sponsored as always by those wonderful people at Natural Grower, who supply plant-based products for both organic and chemical-free gardening and all of your houseplants. Well, as always, it's lovely to be back with you, and I hope you're all keeping well. And if you're in the UK, at least, at the time of recording this today, we are still basking in a long, hot, dry summer. And oh boy, does my garden know about it. Oh, it really does. And so do I, for that matter. All the watering. I garden on the south coast of England in a south-facing garden with a sandy soil. So for me, this has probably been my most challenging year for a long, long time. No sooner have things come into bloom than they are burnt to a crisp. It's sort of soul-destroying, really, because I think we as gardeners put so much focus on the summer and looking forward to our gardens being as pristine as possible. Going forward, I think we're all going to have to seriously reconsider some of the plants that we use in our gardens. Climate change and global warming does appear to be bringing about longer, hotter summers, but coupled with perhaps more temperate but wetter winters. So, the ethos of right plant, right place is even more important today than it's ever been. Now, right plant, right place is something that Beth Chatto championed many, many years ago. You'll probably all know Beth was renowned for her books, including Planting Inspiration for Dry, Shady, Gravel and Woodland Gardens, and much more. She was a multi-award-winning plantswoman and was described as one of the most influential horticulturalists for the last 50 years. A few weeks ago, I chatted with award-winning author and very popular speaker Catherine Horwood via Zoom. Catherine's biography, Beth Chatto, A Life with Plants, won the European Garden Book of the Year award in 2020. Now, I'm going to ask you to please accept my apologies for the sound quality in small parts of this interview. Great as technology is, sometimes it's not quite as good as we hope it to be. I started our chat by asking Catherine how she first met Beth.
Well, I got to see her, I suppose, the first years ago when I was going to Chelsea, and I was one of those people who crowded around her stand because it was so revolutionary at the time. And so I've always been a great fan. I've been a great fan of her writing. Because she's one of those, I've written a lot about gardeners, as you know, and I always feel the ones from the past who have lasted longest have been the ones who've written beautifully, like Christopher Lloyd, Jekyll, all those. And Beth was one of those. You could hear her voice in the way she wrote. But how I came to write the book is that a good few years ago now, I was living in Suffolk. And I just finished my book, Gardening Women, which is a history of women in gardening. Mm-hmm. And I ended up with Beth, as I was such a great fan. And Christopher Woodward, director of the Garden Museum, said, "What are you going to do next?" And I had a few ideas. And he said, "Well, how would you feel about going and helping Beth Chatto organise her archive, because she's donating it to the Garden Museum?" Well, I think that's how long I thought. I mean, there was no time gap. I just said, yes, of course, I'd be absolutely thrilled and delighted to do that. So that there started a sort of a weekly trip over to the gardens and properly getting to know Beth Chatto, helping go through her, sift her archive, which was sort of in old cupboards, mouldy cupboards. And then every week Beth would come to me and she'd sort of give me an envelope and she'd say, "You know, just throw it away if you don't think it's important." And I'd open it and out would fall letters from Christopher Lloyd. And I'd go, no, everything's, everything's precious, Beth, everything's going.
So Catherine, when was this?
This was about 10 years ago.
About 2011, I thought.
2011, yeah. Yes, it was. But that's right, because Gardening Women came out in 2010. So it was 2011. And then Beth asked me with her granddaughter, they asked me whether I'd write the biography because she'd got to know me. She trusted me, obviously. And that was just life-changing for me, sort of having this honor of sitting down, talking to her every week, recording our interviews. And then she started giving me her personal diaries, and these didn't go to the museum.
So the development of the archive material that you started work on, how long were you actually working alongside her on that aspect?
Oh goodness, it took a long time. I mean, because I was only going once a week, and there was nowhere I was working in the cafe. They were just bringing me out boxes, you know, every week. So finally, the archive went to the museum 2 years before lockdown, and it's now been catalogued. They got funding for an archivist who spent a year cataloguing the material, and it's all digitally available now. Sadly, I think a lot of people might be disappointed. There are no or very few plans. Beth didn't work like that. She was a very hands-on person, so there are pictures in my book of her laying out the gravel garden using hose pipes to show where the beds were going to go. So very little was written down in that respect.
So during the time that you were working with her on the archive, you obviously got to know her. Did she at any point sort of drop any hints about, I'd like you to write a biography? Did that come up in conversation? Was it complete surprise when she asked you?
Well, I've got to be honest. Obviously, I really hoped that would come out of it, but it was never a given. No, I mean, I went there just to work on the archive.
So had anybody said at any point, this is something that Beth is looking to do, you know, sort of this could come your way?
Well, Beth had always planned to write her own autobiography. But by the time I started going there, it was pretty obvious this wasn't going to happen. I mean, she was nearing her 90s, she's in her late 80s. It wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to happen. And her granddaughter had joined the business to help it. And Julia, who's brilliant, I think I'm sure you know her because she's a member of the guild. And she's, by her own admission, she's not a gardener, but she's a terrific businesswoman. We get on very well together, and so that's how it sort of came about.
And you were obviously over the moon when you were asked to write the biography.
I was, of course, yes, but also a bit daunted.
Well, I was going to say, because Beth was a bit of a legend in her own lifetime, unlike others who sort of like become a legend after they pass. How did you feel the weight of responsibility? Beth Chatto has asked me to write her biography.
Absolutely, especially when the diaries started coming my way, because there's actually a complicated story in her private life, which came out of the diaries and our talks, of course, and you know, Beth could be quite terrifying.
Well, they say, and you've written in the book, there's a Beth way of doing things and a wrong way of doing things. And I wondered, Beth quite a formidable lady? Did she know what she wanted? And
oh my God, did she know what she wanted? Yes, she certainly did. I think from a little girl, she knew what she wanted.
Yeah.
And a member of staff, not a male member of staff, told me that she could make grown men cry.
Oh, goodness. No,
And yet, she inspired enormous loyalty. I mean, you either got on with her or you didn't, in which case you were out. But if you did, then, I mean, most of the staff who are there now had been with her for decades.
Right.
And they were like her family, you know, around her. But yes, it was a big responsibility. She saw some of the early chapters that I wrote and out came the red pen and, you know.
Well, I was going to ask, did you actually sit down when Beth had asked you to write her biography? Did you sit down and did she say, this is how I want to do it? This is how I want to proofread. Is there going to be like a trial period for you? Because you might not work out.
No, that was never said. And at that point, we didn't have a publisher either. But it was I made the decision that it was to be done chronologically, because there was so much information I had to sort of process and decide how it was going to, and
yeah.
that it was not going to be a picture book. It was going to be a proper biography. And I started writing. I mean, and as I said, I had these early chapters that I showed to Beth. And, you know, she made sort of small corrections, but she was happy with them. And we both knew the direction that the book was going to go in. When the revelations came out, I discussed this with Julia. Beth was sort of quite frail by this point.
Yeah.
And we decided actually that we basically, I'm afraid, had to wait until she died to publish.
So for my listeners and anybody who hasn't read the book, and I have read the book, obviously, can you touch on what the revelations are?
Well, they were revelations about her personal life, that she had a long-term affair with a neighbour, which everybody knew about. Everybody, you know, her husband knew about it, her family knew about it, the staff knew about it. So it wasn't a secret in that respect. But I think, as you said earlier, you know, people put Beth on a pedestal.
Yeah.
I put her on a pedestal
before
I knew all this.
Well, I did too. And when I read this, I was somewhat sort of shocked. It's like, my goodness me, this lady who we've all put on this horticultural pedestal, as you say, had a liaison with another guy.
I know. And I couldn't have covered it up.
How did you feel when you became aware of it? Did you become aware of it through the diaries, or did Beth actually sort of say, Catherine, I need to tell you this?
No. I kept coming up against these, because the diaries weren't a complete run. There were missing years for various reasons. Some got lost, I think. I don't know. And she also suffered greatly from depression at points and didn't write a diary. But I kept coming up against this letter H. She'd write something very angry about H, and I'd go to that, you know, her secretary and say, who's H? Her secretary at the time would say, well, that's for us to know and you to find out.
so obviously knew as well. She was in on this secret.
Everybody knew. Anyway, it did come out. I did talk very briefly about it to Beth. And her attitude was, I don't want to talk about it now. It's in the past. Let the diaries speak. Use my diaries.
So she knew that it would be included, but it was sort of moved until after she passed away.
Yes. And he died before Beth did. He was still living quite close by. And so there was his family as well to think about.
Of course. Were they aware of the situation?
Oh, absolutely. They all knew. In fact, his daughter came to the memorial that we had for Beth at the Garden Museum. So it was tricky, but I hope people feel that I've sort of handled it sensitively. And
Very much so, and that's why I was almost afraid to ask you about it, because I knew you either discovered it in a diary or you'd had a conversation, and I wondered how that must have been for you to discover or talk about it with Beth. You handled it extremely sensitively, but also in a manner that it was clear that something had happened, because, as I say, I remember sort of having to reread the first part again. Have I read that correctly? But and yes, I had. And of course, then as the story unfolds, the story of this liaison continues.
Yes.
Let's talk about her husband, Andrew, then. Let's bring Andrew into the picture. It, not a match made in heaven. And of course, now, sort of like in light of what we've just talked about, it wasn't an obvious union, was it?
Absolutely not. I mean, as I say in the book, that I found some press cuttings from when they got married, and it, they called, this was, you know, the beginning of the war, and it was what they called an interesting marriage. And I said this was for a number of reasons, because Beth was much younger than Andrew, but it was the class difference, really. She'd grown up, she was a policeman's daughter who'd grown up in a house without running water and electricity. Very, very simple. Her grandfather was an illiterate farm labourer, which, I mean, obviously wasn't unusual in East Anglia at that time, when everybody, so many people were working on the land. But it was a big leap for her to go from that sort of life to marrying this man whose grandfather had started Chatto & Windus Publishing Company, extremely successful. Upper middle class, really. He'd traveled the world. He'd lived in California as a teenager. And it's that time that had sparked his interest in plants and where they came from. And it was this fascination with plants that had brought them together, you know, as before the war. And he'd obviously fallen instantly in love with her. I think she was so beautiful. She didn't want to marry him because she wanted to be a teacher, and there was a marriage bar.
Because she really enjoyed her time at school, didn't she, Beth?
Oh yes, she did, and that was the one advantage to her. The move to Elmstead Market was that she could go to Colchester Girls High School, very good, and she did very well there. Studied botany, of course. English and botany were her main subjects. And she did marry Andrew because they lifted the marriage bar during the war. When I gave a talk recently, I was telling this, and I was quite horrified when somebody told me afterwards that they'd been a teacher, and the marriage bar hadn't been lifted until the 1970s.
Oh, goodness.
Which is quite terrifying a thought, isn't it? Anyway. So, yes, and there was never any suggestion that you left Andrew because of this, their passion for plants and learning. I mean, this is a man who taught himself Russian so that he could study plants from Russia. And although he wrote millions of words on plant origins, which were never sadly published in his lifetime, but they have, thanks to Noel Kingsbury and the Hardy Plant Society, they've all been, it's been transcribed, and they are available on the Chatto website for people to look at.
Now, the book isn't about her inspirational garden, nor is it about the plants that she popularised. It's about Beth. But of course, the three are very much interlinked, aren't they?
Yes.
When did Beth's love of gardening first start? It was from a very young age, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, as I said, she grew up in this a house not far from, she called it the Styx of Essex. it was a little hamlet north of Chelmsford. And they had a garden there, and that was where she had her first little patch, and she had snowdrops. And doesn't this happen so often? Both her parents were passionate gardeners, and her father particularly, and he taught her how to collect seed and how to string onions. He was a great influence in terms, well, both his parents were, they gardened throughout their lives.
And of course, Beth was renowned for her knowledge of putting the right plants in the right place. But when did that knowledge and understanding and fascination about ecology actually come about? It was quite early on, I think, wasn't it?
I think, yes, it was certainly Andrew who prompted that. Because of this time that he'd had in California, where he was seeing plants like ceanothus and Californian poppies, and he was saying, but we have those back at home, what are they doing here? And then it was explained, actually, this is where they're from. It's funny, you just said right plant, right place. Beth always told me that she doesn't remember ever saying that or inventing it, but it's the phrase that's always associated with her, isn't it?
Very much so.
And she just had this great passion for species plants, you know, that just took over the way she always had unusual plants. And that, you know, she started off flower arranging in the 50s as a young housewife with two small children, but she took her own plants, and she'd always get asked when she went to do demonstrations, you know, where do you get those unusual plants? So when she started the nursery in the 60s, she called it Unusual Plants, because she was already collecting seed. She'd been very influenced by Cedric Morris at Benton End, who'd yes. become a great friend and who gave her plants. And I think people recognize great plants, men and women, recognized in Beth someone who was a really skilled propagator and lover of plants. Mm. And so that's why her nursery has always had these unusual plants that she's either, she wasn't a plant collector, people gave her plants and then she propagated them.
And alongside Cedric Morris, she was also very close friends with Christopher Lloyd, dear old Christopher Lloyd, who was a very yes. close friend of hers.
Yes, I think so. I mean, particularly, although they argued frantically, but I think for many people, Dear Friend and Gardener, the book that they wrote together is one of their favourites. But most people don't know that it was actually a put-up job and that Beth wasn't the first choice to write it, which seems completely bonkers now.
I was going to say, hang on a second, stop right there. This is news to me. My beloved book. So tell me, what's the story behind this then, Catherine?
Well, the story that I found when I went, I was given Beth's editor's archive, the marvellous Erica Haneke, who sadly died, I mean, before Beth did, and she gave me her archive of the publishing correspondence, and in it was the revelation, which I never told Beth, that she wasn't the first choice, that they came up with this idea of Christopher writing a book with another gardener, backwards and forwards.
Oh my goodness.
Now, I don't think I'm going to tell you who it was. You know,
oh,
go back
Catherine.
To the book,
Catherine, I was going to say, just whisper. Not many people listen.
Right, okay. It was Rosemary Thierry.
Oh, goodness me.
It would have been a completely different book.
Absolutely, it would have been, yeah.
Yeah. And they started, that idea was poo-pooed, and it had to be Beth, And then there were all sorts of shenanigans and fallings out with the publishers, because they said that Beth and Christo were writing too much about food and the opera, and what people wanted was gardening, and then Beth and Christo put their foot down and said, no, this is what we want, and anyway, as they say, you know, the rest is history, and it's still in print and all over the world, even in Chinese.
Goodness me, I'm reeling again. It's like the revelation about the liaison with a male friend. Now this, really sort of like alongside garden writer and journalist, I think it should be garden detective for you, Catherine.
I do love that bit. I must say of the writing.
I can't not talk about the Chelsea Flower Show. 10 gold medals for Beth at the Chelsea Flower Show. How did she feel about her first foray at Chelsea Flower Show?
Oh, well, Beth had this sort of faux modesty. And later in life, she sort of did a bit of I didn't know that you won medals. I just went there to enjoy my... Well, that was absolute rubbish, I have to say, because she'd been helping... Pamela Underwood, the Silver Queen, I don't know if I remember, who had Rampart's Nursery in the 60s. So she knew exactly. And she was extremely ambitious and was very disappointed the first year when she only got a silver guild.
silver, just a silver guild. I mean, come on,
just
Beth.
Just a silver guild, exactly. She'd already exhibited at Vincent Square, the lovely Vincent Square, and it was nearly disqualified. This is quite astounding, because they thought she was... So two judges thought she was showing weeds.
Yes, I remember reading this, yeah.
Which of course were things like euphorbias and hellebores that, we all grow now.
Yeah.
But I think what must never be forgotten about Beth is how she changed the way that plants are displayed in the marquee, the tent. Because previously, really nurseries just displayed plants in pots, and you could see the black pots quite
Yeah.
clearly, and they were marvelous, of course. But Beth wanted to bring the garden inside the tent, and she was the first person to do that in the tent. And of course, her displays were astounding because she did these sort of mirrored displays of one side would have plants for the dry area, another for the damp area. And she's remembered the history of the Chelsea Flower Show as the person who changed the way that the marquee looked.
And how important was Chelsea to her? 10 gold medals. Well, eventually she got her gold medal after the silver gilt. 10. How
Next
important
year.
was it to her career and to the garden?
Well, there were a number of factors. The year she got her first big award was 1976. Now, we're all very aware of what the weather was like in 1976.
Yes, I remember
I
it
mean,
well.
up to last week, it was the driest
Yes,
year.
yeah.
So her display of plants for a dry garden couldn't have been better timed. And she was asked by the Sunday Times to do an article, and this is one of her rare plans when she did actually do a plan of planting. The gravel garden didn't exist at that time, but already she knew she was separating out plants because of the conditions that they should be grown in, which was, still a revolutionary idea
Yeah.
in the 70s and 80s. We were all cramming things in, alkaline, not acid lovers, and trying to get hostas to grow in the wrong place.
Yeah.
So we needed to listen to Beth. But the Chelsea Flower Show is, as we all know, it's an enormous undertaking to do every year. And it did get to the point. It was the year of the great storm. She was actually out of the country when it happened, but it decimated parts of East Anglia and her garden as well. And that's when she made the decision that she couldn't concentrate on the garden and Chelsea, that something had to go. And so she went out on a high. She had the
Absolutely.
Victor. She had all the medals the RHS could give her. Her
And of course,
OBE.
talking of medals, the RHS Lawrence Medal, the RHS Victoria Medal of Honour, she was very highly decorated.
She was, and she was actually, I think, almost more proud of the Lawrence Medal, which was
Yeah.
for the display, best display. No, she it, it, she really went out of Chelsea on a high.
Obviously, Chelsea is one thing. Her books, iconic books, I have most of them in my own library here. And I wonder, I speak to a number of authors, and there's always this thing, if you're a gardener and you're a garden writer, the writing process takes you away from your garden and actually gardening. And as you said earlier, Beth was very hands-on. How did she feel
Yes.
about writing? Was it something that she enjoyed? Was she a natural author?
Yes, I mean she was a ferocious editor of her own work, very, very high standards. And she was, I can't think of another term that suits her better. She was a workaholic, and I could tell from, I mean, she wrote her diaries as well. I mean, apart from she'd tend to write her books, as I suppose most gardeners do, in the winter months, when there was slightly less to do in the garden. But she also kept a diary, and these were foolscap diaries with, a day to a page, and they were written from top to bottom. They were
Goodness.
absolutely chock-a-block, and she was often writing them at midnight. She'd finish off the day, and say what time it was, and she said, "Oh, I better go to bed." And now it's gone midnight. she wasn't a great sleeper, so she'd often, you know, wake up early as well. But she enjoyed the writing, and I'm a trustee of the Beth Chatto Education Trust, which is sort of carrying on, all her beliefs, and we're so proud that we've got that all her books, bar one, and we're working on that, are still in print, and that's a testament to how good they are.
And I guess we talked earlier that Beth had always wanted to sort of like be a teacher, and she was a teacher, but just for a couple of years, wasn't she?
Yes.
But
yes.
I guess that sort of background, and sort of like the wanting to pass on education, that teaching background was obviously great when it came to writing books, because Beth's books, as I said earlier, use the word iconic, but I don't use that. They were groundbreaking and still are.
They still are. And they're still referred to endlessly. I mean, particularly because of the one on the dry gardening, which it's changed its title slightly because of the worldwide interest in being able to plant a garden that doesn't need watering, which is, you know, what we all should be thinking about these days. Yeah.
We were talking about accolades earlier, the Victoria Medal of Honour, the RHS Lawrence Medal, but she also won two Lifetime Achievement Awards, one from the Guild of Garden Writers, which is now the Garden Media Guild, and the Society of Garden Designers, the John Brooks Lifetime Achievement Award. How did she feel about that? They're big awards, aren't they?
Yes, I think, I mean, she was thrilled. She was also thrilled. She was given an honorary degree from University of Essex, which is just down the road from the garden, and she couldn't quite believe that when the letter arrived. She said, "Wow, she was absolutely thrilled, and it's so fitting that this year in September there's going to be a symposium. It's the second symposium. We had one 3 years ago. To be held there, which is based on the gardens but brings in speakers from all over the world. So it's a lovely synergy there.
The other thing I wanted to mention is in 2002, Beth was given the OBE. Can you tell us, there's a little bit of a story behind that, isn't there? There were some people working behind her backs to orchestrate this.
Yes. I mean, we all sort of wonder how these honours are, how you get them. And it was actually her staff who put together the application for it, and she knew nothing about it. And they actually managed to hide the letter when it arrived, asking her whether she would like to have it, but that's the way these things are done. And they presented it to her, and you know, she was just overwhelmed. As I said, you know, her staff were like her family, and they were just so proud. And she got it. She went to get it and was given it by Prince Charles, who of course was a great fan.
And of course, he invited her to and asked if she'd been to Highgrove.
He did indeed. He invited her to Highgrove on a private visit, and Beth turned that down really and said no, actually she was going with her staff. She was taking a party of her staff there. And that's sort of typically Beth, really. But she was absolutely thrilled that they did get orders from Highgrove.
Yes. I mean, that doesn't get much better than that, does it?
No.
Beth sadly died in 2018. Did she see a final copy of your book?
No, she didn't, because I actually had to go off and write another book. I had to sort of put the biography on hold because I was asked to write a book on the cultural history of the rose, called Rose for Reaction, which is part of their sort of botanic series. I'd said yes a few years before, and then suddenly realized, oh my goodness, the deadline's approaching, I better get on with this. So I took a year off to write that book, and it was I'd just finished that when Beth sadly passed away. That said, we were actually so relieved that Beth, I mean, if you know the house where Beth lived, it was right in the middle of the gardens.
Mm.
And she lived there for the rest of her life, and that's where she died. And it was just how marvelous. I mean,
yeah.
She didn't have to go into hospital or a home or anything like that. She was in her garden until the moment she died. And then I went back to, by then we did have a publisher. We had Pimpernel Press very interested in the book.
Mm.
And they've been absolutely marvelous. And then it was, you know, full steam ahead for me to finish it and publish it.
Do you remember the last time you saw Beth?
Yes, yes, I do. She was bedridden by that stage, but I'd always go in when I went over to the garden, whatever time of year it was, and she'd always ask me, you know, had I been round the garden? And if I had, I had to tell her what I'd seen. And if I hadn't, she'd tell me what to go and see. Because it's one of those gardens that, you know, people often ask me, oh, what's the best time of year to go and see it? And I can honestly say, you can go any time of year to that garden, and there's something special there.
It's 4 years since Beth sadly passed away, and 3 years since your book was published. What are your enduring memories of Beth?
Oh, I think just the inspiration that she's given to so many gardeners. Mm. We've learned so much from her and are still learning. I mean, James Hitchmo from the University of Sheffield said about her and her garden, it's not just one of the most important gardens of the 20th century, it's one of the most important gardens of the 21st century as well.
Yeah.
And I think the one thing that I remember so much is that she says, we don't look enough at plants. We've got to really look at them. She used to get very annoyed. She'd sit there in her window and she'd see people going past and not actually looking at them.
Yeah. How has the book, the biography, affected or impacted on your career?
Well, I think enormously, because it as you said, you know, it won the European Garden Book of the Year award, which I was absolutely thrilled about, of course. But people want to hear about Beth. So many people have memories. So my talks career just absolutely exploded after the book came out. And even with lockdown, I mean, we know it's been Zoom.
Yes.
And although I give talks on lots of different topics, it's the Beth talk that people want. And it's so lovely because, you know, I always ask, do people know the garden? Have they been there? And the hands shoot up. And so often people will say that they've been to the garden, and yes, they have memories of Beth sort of popping out from behind a shrub with her secateurs, and always sort of willing to answer questions and pleased to have been there.
Well, I'm not surprised, because when we met and we were talking about Beth, I was so excited when you said you'd come along and talk to me about Beth, because she is a legend. She
yes.
was, and she still is, and will continue to be. So it's great to hear more about her. Now,
yes.
Catherine, when did you start writing? How did this interest in writing and journalism and the talks that you give, how did that start?
Oh my goodness, how long have we got? No, because I've always written, and I sort of had a very traditional start. I didn't go to university as a young person. I actually went into journalism and worked for various magazines and ended up as a features editor. And then I had a family and did freelance work for a while, but really regretted not having been to university. So went back at a later stage, got completely hooked, ended up doing a PhD, quite
goodness
bonkers.
Me. A PhD in?
In dress fashion, dress
Okay.
history.
Which is
I
another
looked at,
passion of yours.
yes, it is dress codes. So not horticultural history, but all the time I was gardening because I had a mother who was a passionate gardener. No dress codes. So looking at middle classes, signifiers, tennis clothes, sports clothes, things like that, swimming costumes, history. Just I love all of that.
Now, one question I always ask, or well, I don't always ask, but I'm sometimes told by the authors who I've chatted to, is what was your relationship with the book like, with the biography? Was there a point when you thought, my goodness me, what have I undertaken? This isn't for me. Or was it always something that inspired you to continue and you were excited about? You're
Well, I always
laughing.
I get I'm laughing because I get quite often if I'm doing mentoring or something like that, people will say, oh, books, I've got a book, I've got an idea for a
Yeah.
book, and how do you go about it? How do you get a publisher? How do you get an agent? And I say, can I just tell you something? Books are hell. Books are hell. I mean, there are really good times when you're right when you're doing the research and the writing, but getting it out there,
Yeah.
I say it's worse than having a baby. It's painful.
Now, you're not the
People
first
don't look
person
in
to
the
have said
pram.
that. Somebody else said
Oh.
that to me about it's worse than giving birth to a baby. But I have to say, you've written quite a few, so it can't be that bad.
I know. Well, but again, it's like childbirth. You forget the pain. I've had three daughters. Why you go on and on and you forget the pain? And I'm about to start on another one as well. I must be bonkers. But it's addictive. It is addictive.
So, picking up on that, Catherine, you're starting work on another one. What can you tell us about your next book?
Well, it's the story, a biography of another woman gardener. Who's actually been dead quite a long time. But it's got sex, botany, and politics in it.
Wow.
So I'm hoping, bing, 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 it's going to hit a lot of buttons.
Well, I'm sure it will, Dale. You've piqued my interest immediately, because, say,
Oh.
there were quite a few revelations in Beth's biography. So if anybody hasn't read that, and there can't be many, you must go and buy a copy of that book, because it's just brilliant.
Oh,
It's just
thank you.
lovely to read about this iconic plantswoman, Beth Chatto, her whole life laid out, and the few saucy bits along the way. So
Thank
when will
you.
your next book, do you have a date for publishing?
No. I'm literally just starting. I've been so busy over lockdown with talks and other bits of freelance journalism for newspapers and things like that. I need to just sort of shut off and this is going to take quite a lot of work. I've got a publisher interested, but I'm taking it easy. And I've had I did a revised version of my book on house plants, potted history.
Yes, yeah.
So because of the passionate interest in Instagramming, everybody's Instagramming their food, their cats, and their house plants. So I had to bring that up to date as well. But that's come out. That's been doing well. So no, now the future is this autumn. I keep saying I must do it. I was going to do it during lockdown. It just didn't happen.
So I'm going to push very gently. We're all trying to think now who this could be, but did you come up with this idea, or has somebody approached you to ask you to write this?
She's one of the women that I wrote about in Gardening Women,
Right. Well, I'll be
and
heading off now to have a look.
and she was also one. I've been doing some of the Gardens Trust have been running extremely successful online talk series, and I included her in that series. Because it's just such a, it, she's got such, there's such a fascinating story to tell there.
Catherine, thank you so much for piquing our interest in your next book, for chatting to us about your career and your amazing book. If people want further information about your books, your talks, where can they head to?
To my website, which is very straightforward, katherinehorwood.com.
Wonderful. Catherine, thank you so much for spending time with me today and chatting to us about Beth and your career. It's been wonderful.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Mike.
Sadly, I never met Beth, but I have most of her books in my collection. And as we've said in today's chat, 4 years after her death, she is still a horticultural heroine. I and many others, including your good selves, will continue to be influenced by her outlook on planting. And whether she said right plant, right place or not, her philosophy on planting is something that I am still very mindful of each and every day of my gardening life, and indeed here in my own garden. As always, my thanks to Catherine for spending time talking to us today. You can follow Catherine on her Instagram account, where she is Catherine_Horwood, or you can find out more about her, or indeed book her for a gardening talk, by heading to her website, catherinehorwood.com. Well, thank you so much for spending your time and listening today. I do hope you'll come back and join me next week when I'll be bringing you another heavenly horticultural experience on the podcast. Gosh, that's throwing down the gauntlet, isn't it? And now it's time for me to head out into my own garden, find my watering can and watering my containers, which are drying up at a rate of knots. Happy gardening, everybody. Bye-bye for now. Bye-bye.